Hello and welcome to our CrowdsCast webinar series. My name is Katie Turner and I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at Crowds Financial. Today's topic is Representing Clients with Diminished Capacity, guest hosted by Chastity Grice of the Estate and Family Law Group. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them throughout the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete that post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback, as well as this is a requirement for CLE. And now let's get to today's presentation. Chastity, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Katie, and thank you all for joining us today to talk about some ethical issues that most attorneys will at some point address, will have to address, and how we deal with our representation of a client that may start exhibiting signs of diminished capacity. I'd like to direct you to the PowerPoint presentation, and as Katie mentioned, you'll get a copy of that handout as well. And when you pull that copy out, you'll notice that there's some reference materials that I have put in there, so that if ever this issue comes up and you are not necessarily certain as to how to proceed, you'll have some resources that you can go to. Namely, the American Bar Association. We're going to tailor this conversation around the model rules of professional conduct. I will throw my disclaimer out here now and let you all know that obviously you must, in addition to consulting the American Bar Association's model rules of professional conduct, please also consult your state's rules so that you can ensure that there is clear understanding as to how to proceed in certain dilemmas. The other thing that I would like to say to you all is, please, if you have never taken a look at them, please take a look at the ACTEC commentaries. ACTECFoundation.org has commentaries which would provide notes and almost like a secondary resource to consider and consult when concerning a model rule of professional conduct and how you may need to handle a particular situation. NALA also has aspirational standards, and they can be found at NALA, www.naela.org. These are all resources that I have consulted at one point or another when representing a client with diminished capacity. Just a little bit about me very quickly. I am an attorney here in Memphis, Tennessee. I am a partner at the Estate and Family Law Group. I have been practicing law now for 16 years and have practiced primarily in the areas of probate and estate administration, as well as elder law. I spend my time focusing on working with families who are caregivers of individuals who have special needs or additional needs, as we like to say, where they may need some additional assistance. And so I spend my time counseling families on the best ways to do that and to provide the best quality of life for their loved ones at the end of their life. We're going to start our discussion today with Model Rule of Professional Conduct 1.14, which tells us as an attorney how to handle a relationship with the client who may start to exhibit signs of diminished capacity. Specifically, the rule 1.14 says that when a client's capacity to make adequately considered decisions is diminished for whatever reason, the lawyer shall, as far as reasonably possible, maintain a normal client relationship with the client. Now, if you're anything like me, when you first read that rule, you say, well, what does a normal client relationship look like with someone who may have some mental impairments? And so that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about some day-to-day situations that have come up in my practice and in the practice of friends of mine and colleagues of mine, where we've had to consult this rule as well as the commentaries and determine how to proceed when a client has diminished capacity or if there is a concern that they may have diminished capacity. Model Rule of Professional Conduct 1.14 initially says, as an attorney, we have to maintain that normal client relationship. But 1.14b does specifically say that once the lawyer reasonably believes that this client has diminished capacity, and because of that diminished capacity, believes that the client is at risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm, unless there is action taken, then the lawyer may take what's reasonably necessary in order to protect that client. Whatever action is reasonably necessary, we're going to talk about what that means. There are different scenarios there, and there obviously is going to be a what I call a balancing act when you are seeking to protect your client who may or may not know that they need protection. Model Rule of Professional Conduct 1.14c specifically says that information relating to the representation of a client with diminished capacity remains to be protected by Rule 0.16. So that's the balancing act that I've referenced, and we're going to talk about here shortly, that a lawyer has to understand when you are representing a client that is exhibiting signs of diminished capacity, you have a primary role, and your primary role is to attempt to advocate and represent that client to the best of your ability as though they are not diminished in any way. However, in the real world, most of us know that this isn't always possible when the client is starting to lack the ability to have meaningful conversation with you. And that's when you now have that secondary responsibility to possibly need to take protective action. If, in fact, you believe that but for that protective action, your client could suffer some harms. I will say before we move forward that I know that Katie mentioned it earlier, but I much rather enjoy having conversations. And while I enjoy giving this presentation, if a question comes up in the midst of my discussion, please don't hesitate to put that question in the chat area immediately, because that question, if it comes up for you, it may very well come up for someone else. And it allows for a more natural conversation, if you will, rather than waiting until the end of our presentation. Thank you. So let's talk about it. What is diminished capacity? If you have at any point or another consulted Model Rule of Professional Conduct 1.14 and or you've had a situation that has come up where a client starts to exhibit these signs of not quite understanding what you're talking about, then you know that when you read the rule, and particularly in a lot of state rules of professional conduct, you don't necessarily see a definition of what exactly diminished capacity means. Well, the American College of Trust and Estates Council has commentaries where they have themselves defined what it means to have diminished capacity. And they have defined a client with diminished capacity as someone whose intellectual acuity is so substantially impaired as a result of some illness, condition, or injury that particular person lacks the ability to make informed financial, medical, or personal decisions. And the key term there, to me, is informed. If you have a client that comes into your office and they tell you that they want to make a decision, but in questioning them and having that meaningful conversation with them, you find that they are unable to give you reasoning behind why they would like to make that decision, to give you any additional information regarding that decision, then it may be possible that they lack the diminished or that they lack the capacity necessary to make the decision. It may be possible that they are not making an informed decision, that they are simply saying yes and no, and or doing something that someone else may want them to do. And it is our jobs as advocates to ensure that when a client comes to us for the specific purpose of assisting them, that we are assisting them to the best of their ability and sometimes to the best of our ability, rather. And sometimes that means digging deeper into the conversation than the client may want to go. And sometimes it also means reading between the lines and having conversations with our clients to determine whether or not the client's decision is informed. Now, the American Bar Association also has comments to Rule 1.14, and they give us some guidance as to how to approach a situation where a client may be exhibiting these signs of diminished capacity. And the comments initially say, well, we have to first determine if, based upon our assessment as the attorney, if the client has the ability to understand to discuss and to reach conclusions about matters involving their well-being. So what that means is it's not enough to simply allow a client to come in your office and tell you what they want. When there is a concern about the client's capacity, then the attorney has the responsibility of going the next step and making sure that the client understands the benefits and the consequences of the decision that they are asking you to help them make. It's also important for you as the attorney to discuss in detail what the client is asking you to do. More specifically, if the client is asking you to do something that appears to be an unnatural decision, and we'll talk about that later, or if the client is asking you to do something that appears on its face as though it can hurt them, then it is very important for the attorney to understand the reasoning behind why the client is doing so. Now, to be clear, clients are absolutely permitted to make bad decisions, right? When you have the mental capacity to understand the nature of that decision, when you have the ability to understand the consequences of that decision, you are absolutely permitted as an adult to make a bad decision. And I say bad decision, of course, that's subjective. But if it's a decision that hurts the client, they absolutely have the right to do that if they have the capacity to understand why they're doing it and to understand the consequences of doing it. It's the attorney's responsibility to make an assessment to determine that, well, first and foremost, the client has the capacity to do those things. And if the client does not, or if there is a question about whether the client lacks the ability to meaningfully make these decisions, then we have to consult Rule 1.4 and we have to go the next step to ensure that we are protecting our clients, sometimes from themselves. The American Bar Association comments also say that it's important for us to determine whether the client simply needs assistance with managing their affairs or if they're incapable of managing their affairs. That's different. You can very well be disabled and able to and competent enough to make decisions for yourself. A client that is aging is not the same as a client who is incapable of making decisions. And that is sometimes a misconception that a person who may have a disability and or a person who is aging absolutely cannot make decisions for themselves. It is totally untrue. I have had clients in their 90s who are way more cute than some of those who are half of their age. So it's important for as an attorney to speak to the client, have conversation with the client. Let's not make it an interview per se. Let's not make it appear as an examination, even though deep down it is. Let the client talk to you. Let the client guide you through the conversation. And if you find that the client is unable to meaningfully advocate for themselves and or the client is unable to explain to you and articulate their reasoning behind decisions that they'd like for you to make, then there may be a question of diminished capacity there. Well, then once the attorney has determined whether or not the client has the ability to understand, discuss, and reach the conclusions about their own well-being, then we're going to decide, do they need help? Do they need just some help, but not someone else to step in and take care of all of their affairs? And if they need assistance, then that may be the perfect opportunity to discuss supported decision-making, which is also an option for a client who may have some diminished capacity, but they mentally are still able to articulate enough of their affairs to appoint someone to help them make those decisions. And then as I discussed earlier, it is our responsibility to maintain communication with the client as best as possible, to maintain that normal attorney-client relationship. Now, I know that this may sound to some of you as though it is common sense, right? Of course you maintain communication with your client as your client. However, in the real world, as I like to say, In situations where a client may have diminished capacity, you might find that you start getting more calls from family members or friends or loved ones of the client, less calls from the client. And when that happens, it's certainly not unusual, but it is the attorney's responsibility to maintain the communication with the client as best as possible. And maybe it's gotten to a point where it is not possible to have communication solely with your client. Depending on the level of the capacity issue that your client may be facing. The client may wish to include family members in your conversations. And for the most part, that's okay, so long as there's no overt actions taken by family members that make you, as the attorney, feel as though there's someone taking advantage or attempting to take advantage of your client's diminished capacity. It is permissible to allow family members to participate in the conversation with your client. But at the end of the day, it's very important to maintain the relationship with your client as best as possible. So let's talk about the fact that as clients age and or if clients become disabled, there is a declining capacity, which is very different than diminished capacity. We talked about the ACTEC's definition of what diminished capacity is. And I'm just going to review that very quickly so that we could talk about declining capacity. When discussing diminished capacity, ACTEC has defined that client as someone whose intellectual acuity is so substantially impaired that that person lacks the ability to make informed decisions about themselves, whether it be financial, whether it be medical, whether it be personal decisions, but they cannot make informed decisions. However, declining capacity is someone, it can be exhibited by someone who is beginning to show the signs of reduced capacity, but who still has the ability to make informed decisions. So this is someone who may start to show this occasional forgetfulness. They may show some confusion. They may get disoriented a little bit, but not so much so that they are unable to make informed decisions. And that's the first step, right? That may be where your client is when they come in your office. They may be at a declining stage. That may be, in fact, why they're in your office, because they're noticing that they're starting to forget things a little more often than they used to. They're noticing that they may not be as sharp mentally as they're used to being. They may only be exhibiting declining capacity as opposed to diminished capacity. And if they're doing that, then that's a prime example of a situation where you can have a conversation with your client about seeking the appointment of an agent, in fact, through their powers of attorney. Talk to them about supporting decision-making, to already have someone in place to assist them at a time where they may then transform from having declining capacity to diminished capacity. Now, let's say we get to a client, and this client at this point is exhibiting some signs of diminished capacity. And in showing those signs, they're not able to articulate to you fully what, in fact, they want their plan to be. If you're talking to them about developing an estate plan and they can't quite say what they want, but perhaps there's somebody else in the room that's filling in the blanks. This happens more often than what I'd like to admit. And sometimes that family member or those family members are really trying to be helpful. They're just really trying to help mom to say what it is they know that mom wants to say, right? It's not always a situation where the person is attempting to take advantage of that client. However, there are situations where that's in fact what could be happening. If you find a situation where your clients are unable to meaningfully have a conversation with you, and that there are individuals around them who may be filling in the blank a little too much, and perhaps they're asking you to do things that are beneficial to them, that are to the detriment of other family members. So if, for example, if you have a client that comes in with their son and the son is telling you, well, my mom told me that she wants to change her will and leave everything to me, but she has five children. That is what I mean when I reference an unnatural disposition, which is quite possible. And there are clients who do that knowingly. It's our responsibility to determine in these conversations, though, if the client wants to do that, is that decision an informed decision or not? And if it is not an informed decision, then the client can't articulate their reasoning to you. They can't articulate the fact they understand the consequences of making this decision. And it may be then that there is an elephant in the room. It may be then that the son is attempting to take advantage of mom. And our responsibility in that scenario, and in all scenarios, in my opinion, is to protect the person who has the diminished capacity. So then there's always this question, though. When you have a client and you have family members who are participating in the conversation, there's always that balancing act and trying to determine whether or not the family members are there to help themselves or to help your client. And sometimes there is a crossroad where we've made a determination that this family member is encouraging something that is harmful to our client. When going back to Rule 1.14, we have that obligation to maintain the client relationship, right? It's our jobs to make sure that we are sticking with our client, that we are not doing what the client's son is asking us to do, what the daughter's asking, what the friend. We are talking to our client. And if our client can advocate to us what specifically they would like to do and why meaningfully, then Rule 1.14b tells us that as the attorney, we are able to now take protective action that is reasonably necessary. So then that leads us to the question, well, what is reasonably necessary protective action? The very first question that we would ask ourselves to determine if reasonably necessary protection action should happen is whether or not the client is at risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm if action is not taken. So that's the burden. The burden that we have as attorneys is to determine if the decision that the client is attempting to make, if it is being unduly influenced by someone else, if there is something that is happening here that if not for us, but for the action of the attorney, if some action is not taken, this client is going to be hurt. The client's going to be hurt physically, they're going to be hurt financially, but they're going to be hurt in some way if we don't do something. That's the burden in determining what is reasonably necessary. There's some examples of things that the rule allows us to do. We are allowed to consult with family members. Now, what if there's a family member that comes to every visit, every client meeting, and that's the family member that you suspect is taking advantage of your client? Are you permitted to talk to other family members? If, but for the fact that you don't do something, your client's going to be harmed, then I think Rule 1.14 says yes, you are permitted to consult with another family member if possible for the specific purpose of protecting your client, to circumvent something from harming your client financially, physically, or otherwise. Now, it may be a situation where we just need a little more time to see if the client needs intervention. For example, if the client has a medical emergency and you speak to the client the day after that medical emergency and they are unable to fully communicate with you, well, it may not be that the client lacks the capacity to make decisions. It may not be that the client has a permanent diminished capacity. we may just need a little more time for the client to deal with their illness and to heal. So it is perfectly necessary in that case for us to say, well, let's meet in a couple of weeks and see, let's see where we are at that point. Let's take some time. You have some rest. And we'll have a conversation again. Allowing that additional time to reconvene to determine whether your client needs intervention or not is sometimes necessary under circumstances, which would allow you to not necessarily make any overt actions at that time, but to determine whether or not the client needs some additional support by allowing some time to pass to see where the client ends up in a couple of weeks. And I mentioned earlier, and I'll mention again, considering that supported decision-making, it is a very helpful opportunity for the client. If a client has, especially if a client has declining capacity, where they're still able to make informed decisions, they're still able to tell you that they trust their oldest son to assist them in managing their finances because their son has always helped them. You know, they know that they trust their niece to be the one to take care of their personal needs because she's the one who takes them to the doctor, who helps make doctor's appointments. Then it's appropriate then to talk to the client about some supported decision making, to have maybe expanded powers in their powers of attorney to give to their loved ones to help them in their time where they may be declining, but not yet diminished in terms of their capacity. It's also appropriate to talk to clients about retaining professional services. In most states, for sure, in my state here in Tennessee, there are many organizations that are set up as third-party representative payees for Social Security purposes, and they will serve as rep payees for our clients. They will manage your client's money. They will help manage their assets, manage their affairs. So if the client comes in and says, you know, I need help maintaining my bills, making sure that my bills are paid on time. I'm sometimes starting to forget. I don't know how to set it up on auto pay. I need help, but I don't trust my family to do that. There are organizations out here at reasonably rates who would do that, or reasonable rates, I should say, who would actually help clients manage their finances and pay their bills so that they're comfortable and they're confident to know that I'm being taken care of, even at a time where mentally I may not be able to handle those decisions myself anymore, or I'm declining. So I know that there's going to come a time where I may not be able to do this anymore. So advising clients of professional services that are available to them. There are elder care consultants who specifically specialize in working with elders and helping them transition in their lives. As clients are aging and start to have more needs, whether that need involves cleaning their home, medication management, assisting with maintaining doctor's appointments, transporting to doctor's appointments, there are elder care consultants out here whose business is to work with elders and to make sure that they have all elements of their lives covered when they need assistance. And then, of course, as the last and I guess the most dramatic response in terms of taking protective action is consulting adult protective services. Whether you're in a state that requires mandatory reporting or not, is something that I would encourage everyone to find out. You always want to know if you are practicing in a state where there is mandatory reporting, specifically in the elder law and elder abuse area. And if in fact you are, then you're going to have more of a balancing act than others, because you now have to determine whether or not you need to consult adult protective services to protect your clients and what you can tell them. Because we have to always be mindful that the attorney-client relationship is still intact. And when a client needs our assistance, and maybe they don't know they need our assistance, And maybe they don't want our assistance, but we know that if we don't act, if we don't take that protective action, the client will be harmed financially or physically. Then we may not have a choice but to consult Adult Protective Services, in which case we have to be sure that we are only disclosing the information necessary to get the investigation open, to get the client some help. So an attorney must make sure that you are not disclosing specific information that may on its face appear to be adverse to your client's interest. And sometimes disclosing the client's capacity in and of itself may be adverse to their interest. So we have to be very mindful when calling organizations like Adult Protective Services, especially if it's for our client, that we're not disclosing information that is protected by the attorney-client relationship. And then in the event that a client ends up in court, when there are conservatorship and or guardianship proceedings, depending on which state you're in and what you reference that as, it may be necessary for guardian ad litem to be appointed. And in some cases where your client may or may not agree to a conservatorship and or guardianship, it may be necessary for the appointment of an attorney ad litem, a person who is appointed by the court for the specific purpose of advocating for the client, which is different than a guardian ad litem, because a guardian ad litem's responsibility is to provide a report to the court as to what's in the client's best interest. And if you practice in this area, then I know that you know that there is sometimes a big difference between what's in the client's best interest and what the client wants. And in that situation where there may be pending guardianship and or conservatorship proceedings, then you as that person's attorney, if you've represented them prior to that initiation, you have to be mindful as to who your loyalty lies to, or who your loyalty goes to, rather. You know, your client remains your client. And not only do we have a responsibility under the rules of professional conduct to our current client, but we have responsibilities to our former clients as well. So in the event that there is a guardianship proceeding against our former client, the proceeding in and of itself is adverse, which might mean that you are conflicted out as the attorney for your client and unable to do anything in that proceeding meaningful unless you are appointed by the court as your client's attorney ad litem. So you want to be very mindful of that. Now, I will say I did some quite extensive research on this question a couple of years ago, and every state has a different outlook on this particular issue. Some states will actually give permission to attorneys to file protective proceedings against the client, which would be a guardianship proceeding and or a conservatorship proceeding. And some states do not. Some states specifically say that the proceeding in and of itself is adverse or may be adverse to the client's interest. So you're walking a very fine line. I would encourage you to ensure that you know what your state's rule of professional conduct allows, and consult any ethics opinions in your state before proceeding in that way. Now, I know I've talked about how we have to have this this balancing act, but again, although we are maintaining this attorney-client relationship when representing a client with diminished capacity, there is some implied authority that we have. Rule 1.14B and Rule 1.14C of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct both allow a lawyer to make some disclosures of information that may otherwise be considered confidential in order to prevent the client from being substantially harmed. So it is important before you disclose confidential information to ensure that that is your standard, that if you don't disclose this information, what would happen to your client? And if the answer to that is that your client would be substantially harmed whether it's in a financial way or a physical way or a mental way, then you are absolutely encouraged to make as much disclosure as possible, only as necessary for the purpose of protecting your client. But again, it's a balancing act and making sure that you're protecting your client, but also protecting the sanctity of the relationship between an attorney and a client. Now let's talk about some tools that you can use in order to combat the possibility that your client may lack testamentary capacity. If they're coming in to execute a will, they want to execute or they want to draft a new will, and they could possibly be unduly influenced by their loved ones. Let's talk about some things that we as attorneys can do to recognize the possibility of undue influence. Well, the number one, I think, tool of practice that every attorney should use is the ability to have independent conversations with the client. You've got to put the family members out of the room. You know, I know that as our clients are aging, chances are high that their children and their nieces and nephews and possibly grandchildren or friends are going to bring them to your appointments. They're going to bring them to your office, right? And they're going to naturally want to sit in the conference room with them and tell you all about how their other sibling is just a terrible person. And they're going to tell you all about all the negative things that they could think of so that their mom can make a decision that might only benefit them, right? There is a strong possibility that if you've not had that happen before, that, you know, your time is coming as an estate planning or an elder law attorney or in any other area of law where you are representing a client whose capacity is starting to decline. You will have situations where family members will come in. They will demand that you take actions that may or may not be in your client's best interest. Well, the very first step in combating the possibility that your client is being unduly influenced is getting them in the room by themselves, having conversation with them by yourself in the best way that you can, to the best of your ability, making sure that the family members are away from that conference room so that your client can feel comfortable and confident that what they say to you is protected, that it is confidential and that it is private and that you are working for them and not their family member. It's also important to ask open-ended questions when you're talking to your clients, making sure that you're giving them the opportunity to talk. I know as attorneys, it may be our instinct sometimes to have the most to say, but I think that we do ourselves a disservice when we do that. And I've learned that sometimes just being quiet and letting our clients talk will show some things. It will tell us some things. We may learn more about family dynamics in that conversation. We may learn more about the client in that conversation. If you ask your client yes or no, well, questions that would elicit a yes or no answer, you may just get your yes or no. You may not get an opportunity to observe whether or not the client does have diminished capacity, because you may not know if the yes or no is a true yes or no. But if you ask open-ended questions, then that opens up the opportunity for your client to speak freely to you. And that also allows some more trust, that allows the client to be more comfortable, but it allows you also to be able to tell if the client is exhibiting any signs of diminished capacity. If they're starting to forget their children's names, if they can't remember their address, their home they've lived in for 40 years, those things only come out when you start asking open-ended questions, when you allow more communication with the client. You may find that when you do that, the client may start to say things like, well, my son, Johnny, he just keeps telling me that I need to leave everything to him and that my daughter has been stealing from me. And Johnny's telling me that my daughter's doing this. So I'm just going to leave everything to Johnny because my feelings are hurt. I can't believe my daughter would do that. You know, and that identifies a family dynamic that you need to know about, because it may be that the client's decision is not informed at all, that in fact, it may be uninformed. It may be based upon the things that are being told to them from that particular child. You may also find that in asking those open-ended questions, the client just is wanting to do whatever it takes to avoid conflict, even if that means making a decision that might hurt them. Another tool is actually recognizing the actors in the room. Recognize who's the person doing everything to get your client in the office with you. Did the daughter call and make the appointment? Did the daughter email you documents for you to review? Is the daughter in the room asking all the questions? Is she talking more than anybody? She may be the one that is influencing these decisions. And all influence isn't bad influence, right? It's our jobs to determine what influence our client is receiving and if that influence is harming them. And is it affecting their ability to make informed decisions? Because if it is affecting their ability to make a decision that is informed, then that opens the door to be unduly influenced. Because then the client makes decisions that may be very different than what they want, and they may not understand the consequences of that. And that leads me to the final tool, recognizing unnatural dispositions of assets. Now, let me be clear. Clients can leave their estate to anybody. If your client comes in the office and they have the capacity to understand the nature of what they're doing, and they say, I want to leave all of my belongings, all of my assets to my church, none to my children, none to my family. And they absolutely have the right to do that. It's our jobs, though, to make sure specifically when a client is asking for an unnatural disposition, such as that the client is informed. The client has decisions for that, and the client understands the consequences of that. And the reason I say this is twofold. One, we want to make sure that our clients actually know what they're doing here. They actually understand what's happening. And they know that because of that consequence, I am moving forward based on what I want, no matter what the consequence is. Well, but then the other not so obvious reason why you have to pay attention to this is, well, you may also be opening to the door to litigation. You know, if your client has been diagnosed with dementia and they're in the very early signs, they have capacity, but it's starting to be declined. There's a concern there, whether or not they know the consequences of their actions, whether or not they are making informed decisions. But now they're asking you to make an unnatural disposition of their assets. What do you do? Well, you have to make sure that you are comfortable and you've done everything that you can to make sure that this client has made this decision thoughtfully, that you've actually talked this through with them and what happens and what could happen if, in fact, you're leaving everything to a charity as opposed to your family after you've been diagnosed with a disorder that clearly could affect your mind, then you're leaving the ability open for your loved ones to come back and fight that. They will contest that. They will say you didn't understand, you didn't know what you're doing. And I think that is our jobs as the attorneys to make sure that we've documented everything that we possibly can to show that the client had the ability, the mental ability to understand the nature of what they're doing and the consequences of that. There is a handbook that I've used for many years that is called The Assessment of Older Adults with Diminished Capacity. It's a handbook for lawyers. There's now a second edition, and you can find this on your slide 20 in your handouts. There's an email there. There's also a website where you can get that handout. And I've had situations that came so close in terms of not quite being sure if the client had capacity to make some decisions that I've consulted that handbook, which actually will give you questions to ask. It has checklists. It's very, very helpful when determining whether or not a client may or may not have capacity to make decisions that they're asking you to make. So if these things come up, if you go through these tools and you determine that there's enough here that you're concerned, then at this point, you should consult the handbook and you should ask these specific questions to the client. And you should determine at that point if your client can make the decisions they're asking you to make. And it's okay if you get to the end and say, I don't believe that this is an appropriate way to change your estate or to handle your will. I don't believe that you're at a place where you're able to do that at this time. So one of the biggest issues that comes up, especially in the estate planning world, is who is the client? Who is the client? Is your client? If the daughter comes in and brings mom in and says, you know, mom wants to sell her house to me. Can you draft the deed? You've not had a conversation with mom, but daughter's doing all the talking. You have to make sure that at all times you have clearly identified who the client is. If you represent the principal, who is mom, then it is your responsibility to advocate for and to communicate with mom and to ensure that mom is making an informed decision outside of the presence of anyone else. If, however, you're representing a fiduciary, so let's say the daughter comes in and she's power of attorney and she's a potential client. And she's saying, look, I am my mom's power attorney. She wants to sell her house to me. What do I do? By the way, I think that's a terrible idea most of the time. But in this particular example, the very first thing you have to do as an attorney is identify who is your client going to be if this is a potential client. And determine that at the onset of the conversation so there's no confusion among the family whose responsibility it is to make decisions. Is it mom's decision or is it mom's agent? The Model Rule of Professional Conduct 1.2 talks about that. It talks about the lawyer's representation. First, once you identify who your client is, what your job is. And quite honestly, it can get clouded a bit when you have a lot of family members who are involved in some decision making. And when family members want you to do what they want you to do. It also comes up sometimes when you have family members who actually are paying your fees. Let's say they've given mom the money to hire you to draft her will. But they want mom to do what they want mom to do. It is our responsibility to be very clear at the onset of the conversation who we're representing and who we are taking our marching orders from. If, in fact, you're retained by the fiduciary, then obviously your responsibilities are a bit different. You do have duties that are owed to your client who's the fiduciary, but anytime there is a situation where your client, who is the power of attorney, is acting on behalf of a person with diminished capacity, we still have a duty to that person with diminished capacity. And I know, again, this is the balancing act, so I know it can seem overwhelming sometimes to determine what our responsibilities are. But it is our responsibility to ensure that when we're representing a fiduciary, that we understand and that the client understands that their job is to act in the best interest of the principal. So if you are representing the daughter who is a power of attorney for mom, daughter's responsibility is to make decisions that are in the best interest of mom, not daughter, not daughter's other siblings, but mom. And your job as the attorney is to make sure that that daughter is acting in the best interest of mom and that daughter only does the things that are in mom's best interest. And in the event that your client, who is the fiduciary, acts improperly or does anything that is adverse to a person that has diminished capacity, then we may have an obligation to disclose that. If that means that if we don't disclose it, it could cause that person with diminished capacity to be harmed in any way. I would encourage you to consult your state rules if you have that situation happen. Specifically, if you have that situation occur in a court proceeding. If there is a pending conservatorship, and your client is the conservator for their mom, and your client is misusing mom's money, you as the attorney, although you represent the daughter, you have an obligation to the court. You have an obligation to that person, to mom with diminished capacity. you have an obligation to ensure that her assets are protected as best as possible. So if you find out that your client is acting against the best interests of that person with diminished capacity, you may have an obligation to disclose as well. Now, the extent of that disclosure is based upon your state rules. So I would encourage you to then consult with your state rules of professional conduct. I've had situations come up where I've even had to request an ethics opinion. And in our state, we are permitted to ask for an informal ethics opinion based on our situation alone. And sometimes that has come up where I'd rather understand specifically what my responsibility is than guess. And sometimes you have to read these rules and read between the lines, and everything isn't so cut and dry. Some things that are very clear, very black and white, but some situations may not be. So I would encourage you to utilize the resources that we have by our bar to assist us in making good decisions and acting ethically. All right, I have a couple of case studies. I know we have a few minutes here. I just want to make sure that we don't have any questions. Please, again, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to type those questions in the chat box. I'm happy to answer them immediately upon your question being entered there. All right, case study number one. Client Susie calls you about an issue with her mortgage company. She received a letter threatening foreclosure. But she says, I've been paying my bill every month. I don't understand. I should not be going through this. Can you help me? As you continue to talk to Susie, you're asking open-ended questions, and you learn that Susie is not able to tell you who her bank is, who her bank account is with. She's not able to tell you the monthly mortgage payment. Now, you've been the family lawyer for 15 years, so you know Susie, and you know that Susie's been in that house for 20 years, and so her mortgage has been the same the majority of that time. You are concerned that Susie is not able to understand your advice or understand anything going forward in terms of handling this issue. What are your responsibilities? Under Rule 0.14, you are permitted to do a few things that are necessary to help. And this actually falls under the financial umbrella. The very first question that you're supposed to ask is, first and foremost, if I don't do anything, will my client be harmed? Now, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know that it's an automatic, but to the best of your ability, if you don't do anything, would your client be harmed? And in this particular case, my answer would be yes. It is quite possible that Susie would be harmed financially if you don't help her. But Susie may not be able to meaningfully help herself because she's unable to make informed decisions at this time because she cannot identify things that are basic for her, that should be basic for her, based on your understanding. You've been her family lawyer for all this time, so she should know how much her mortgage is. She absolutely, even if she doesn't know the exact amount, she should be able to identify it. She should be able to tell you who her bank account is with. If she's had the same bank for however many years, or even if she changed banks, she should be able to communicate those things to you. Rule 1.14 would allow you to call family members. In that conversation, it may be helpful to ask Susie, is it okay if you called her daughter or her son? Is there someone she can speak with, that a friend of hers or whomever that is helping her? Does she have any church members that can help her? In either of those situations, you are permitted under Rule 1.14 to call family, to call loved ones, and or to contact any organizations that are necessary to help prevent that foreclosure for Susie. Case study number two. Client's son, Bill, calls you and schedules an appointment with his mother, Lily. 7 days later, Bill shows up and tells you that Lily wants to transfer her house to him and asks you how much it would be to hire you to do that. Lily does not come to the appointment. You have never spoken to Lily. What is your responsibility? Well, this goes back to what I said initially, that sometimes comes up. First, identifying who your client is. Is your client Bill? And in what capacity? Is Bill his mom's power of attorney? If he is, does he even have the authority to make that transfer? Should he make that transfer? Or is that transfer just not a good idea, not in the best interest of Lily, but also not in the best interest of Bill? That's not necessarily the conversation that you would have with Bill. What you would do is first identify what his role is in this transaction. And that then, if he's the person who is identifying as Lily's power of attorney, then perhaps you need to identify him as the client in his capacity as power of attorney. And then you have a conversation about how it's probably not a good idea to transfer the house to him in his capacity as an agent, in fact. But what if mom is the client? What if Bill says, well, I just wanted to have a conversation with you first, but this is what mom wants to do. And you've identified that in this particular scenario, mom is the client. Then the very first thing that needs to happen is there needs to be a meeting with mom. You have to be very mindful not to have too much conversation with someone who is not the identified client. That's why it's important to identify this at the onset of the conversation so that you're not an hour later into a conversation with someone who seemingly won't be your client, because that could potentially cause a conflict later on if you're representing mom and mom does something that's adverse to Bill. Then Bill may say, well, but I met with you first and I had the understanding that you were my client. So to avoid any potential conflicts that could arise, you absolutely must identify your client at the very onset of the conversation. Once you identify the client, if you determine that mom is the client, then your next step is to speak to mom. When you talk to mom, you'll go back to those tools that we talked about. Let's have a conversation, an open-ended discussion. Help me understand the dynamics of the family. And you'd have a discussion with mom to ensure that her decision to transfer her house to Bill is an informed one and that she has specific reasons for doing so. Now, sometimes those reasons or sometimes the goals of the client may be able to be accomplished in a different way. I think it's our responsibility to talk to our clients about that. Specifically, if the client is asking for an unnatural disposition, if the client can articulate true reasons, then it is important to document. It is important to have these reasons articulated in writing so that in the event that Lily's other children, if she has any, contest this document later, that you have done your due diligence to ensure that you show on paper that your client made informed decisions. All right, we just have just a couple of minutes left, so we've got enough time to go through this last case study. All right, we have a former client and her name is Sherry. Sherry's 75 years old. Sherry's husband just died. They were married for 50 years. 2 months after his death, Sherry calls you and she tells you she wants to name her new boyfriend as her beneficiary. She wants to do a new will and she wants your help in making changes to all of her beneficiary designation forms on her bank accounts to name her boyfriend Dave. Dave is 35 years younger than Sherry. He's not working. And during your conversation, you learn from Sherry that she doesn't know, she can't tell you Dave's last name. She can't tell you whether he has any children. She can't give you any information about his background. She's also disclosed to you that it is her desire to start to pay Dave $3,000 a month in exchange for his decision to live in her home. You have concerns. What do you do? Well, you go back to Rule 1.14 and you make a determination. You ask the question, if you don't do anything at this point, could or would your client, Sherry, likely be subjected to some harm, financial, physical, or otherwise? In the event that you don't do what Sherry's asking you to do, there is a possibility that maybe she'll go somewhere else. There's a chance here that Sherry's being unduly influenced. Could it be that Sherry is so grief-stricken from the loss of her husband that she's not thinking clearly? Could she have diminished capacity, even temporarily? That's quite possible. And if in fact you find that in your observation that Sherry has diminished capacity and could be subject to undue influence at this time, then it is quite possible that it may be necessary to take protective action. That protective action could involve a number of things. It could involve contacting other family members. It could involve sending an inquiry to Adult Protective Services. It could involve attempting to have a conversation with Sherry. Now, remember I mentioned earlier, it may sometimes be possible to let some time pass. Maybe this is one of those situations where you may have to talk to Sherry about, you know, let's let a little time pass. And let's maybe meet next month and let's have a conversation again. Now, could you run the risk that Sherry go out and do these things with someone else? Possibly. So that may or may not be an option, but we have to consult all options in a situation where we believe that if we don't do something, that our clients could be substantially harmed. Now, with that, I believe that I am out of time. Again, as I mentioned earlier on slide 20, there are some resources there for you in the event that you are representing clients who possibly have either declining or diminished capacity. And these are great resources to help you walk through those steps in determining what to do next and how to best help our clients at a time of their lives that may be extremely difficult for them. With that said, I've completed my presentation. I don't see any questions, but if anybody has any, please do put them in there, or you're welcome to send them to my email, which is on the screen.
We do have a few questions. We'll start with the first one. What are some things that an attorney should pay attention to when identifying possible undue influence?
So I think that's a good question. I think number one is just reading the room. If the client's in the room with you in the conference room or in your office, reading the room and just, you know, paying attention to who's doing the majority of the talking, who's asking the questions, and then also looking at who benefits from this discussion the most. You know, if you find that, you know, that son is in the room with mom, son is doing all the acting, the talking, and the end result is to benefit son and his children versus, you know, the other five children, then, you know, that might be a true sign that there's something wrong here and that your client is being unduly influenced. So looking, you know, just paying attention to the conversation with the client, letting the client talk to you and tell you why they want to make certain decisions, because sometimes they will tell you something without saying it overtly. Sometimes we can read between the lines when the client is talking to us if you ask open-ended questions and allow them to communicate with you.
Our next question, what are some top mistakes that attorneys make when representing clients with diminished capacity?
Well, one of the mistakes that I've seen and issues that I've seen, especially early in my practice, is just failing to identify who your client is. I've seen attorneys, you know, be in the midst of conservatorship proceedings and not quite clear who they represent. They may be advocating for daughter, but saying out loud that they represent mom, well, then it turns out that they truly are representing the daughter. You know, not identifying a client can really cause issues down the line with conflict, and it could cause issues with the client believing that you have a responsibility that you don't know that you have. So that's a number one, that's a top mistake that I see, just the failure to identify who the client is and take direction and make decisions based upon the client and not the person who may have paid your bill or the person who may have scheduled the appointment.
Our last question, what are some resources that attorneys can use to assist them in working with clients with diminished capacity?
Sure, and that's that list. So that is on slide 20. If you go to slide 20, that's the list of resources that, you know, you can consult. And it typically would allow you to have checklists, know what questions to ask if you're not quite sure what to do under certain circumstances. I would consult those resources. The only thing that I did not include on slide 20 that I should have is the NALA aspirational standards. And that's NAELA.org. NALA is the National Association for Elder Law Attorneys, and they also have aspirational standards, which would give you an idea when you're dealing with clients with diminished capacity as to how to handle certain situations. And they're very helpful standards that I think we should all strive for in our practice.
That is all the time we have for questions today. If we didn't get to your question, we'll follow up with you later this week. Thank you again, Chastity, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon, everyone.